Good afternoon. This is Tamara reading the Decatur Herald and Review. Let's start with the front page for Wednesday, July 9th. We have some great photos on the front page from the Decatur Park District. Lunch and learning, parks offering food, fun, and tutoring. We have park leader Zycori Bass-Plato teaching Kaimiya Pertle, 9, spelling words during the Decatur Park District Summer Lunch Program at Monroe Park on Tuesday, July 8th. Bass-Plato is becoming a CNA, and Kaimiya wants to be a nurse, so she helps her with words and math every day. When at the Park District, it's your job to help the kids, said Bass-Plato. We also have a photo of park leader Scott Mullenix handing out free meals of hot dogs and fruit to Jaking Davis, 7, and Alice Tai, 9, for the Decatur Park District Summer Lunch Program at Monroe Park on Tuesday, July 8th. The program continues until July 25th in 9 different parks. From Brendan Moore in Decatur, Public Safety, Task Force to Tackle Human Trafficking, multi-agent group based in Decatur. A multi-agency task force is being formed to combat human trafficking in central Illinois and will base its operations in Decatur. The task force, to be known as the Illinois Trafficking Enforcement Group, will be led by the Illinois State Police and include the Decatur Police Department and the McLean County Sheriff's Office as partnering organizations. The Decatur City Council on Monday unanimously approved the interagency agreement forming the group. I see it as a no-brainer, said Decatur Police Chief Brad Allen. Human trafficking is real. It's all over rural and urban areas. Decatur's not immune to it. Central Illinois is not immune to it. According to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, human trafficking involves the use of force, fraud, or coercion to obtain some type of labor or commercial sex act. Human traffickers victimize millions around the world and operate in all 50 states. According to the Human Trafficking Hotline, more than 3,000 cases of human trafficking have been identified in the state, and more than 6,000 victims since the hotline's inception in 2007. ISP started its dedicated Human Trafficking Bureau 2 years ago, according to Lieutenant Phil Trumpeter, who oversees the unit. In that time, they have encountered 33 victims and arrested 70 people for trying to engage in sex acts with minors. The unit is now looking to expand its reach to central Illinois. The state police will provide the facilities and expenses to operate it, including evidence storage and training related to operations. The state will cover liability for activities underneath the task force's umbrella. Trumpeter did not disclose how many state police officials would be assigned to the task force, nor did Allen say how many police officers would be involved. While trafficking has generally not been viewed as a large issue in Decatur, the true extent of it is hard to determine because the illicit activity mostly occurs in the shadows. In March, the Decatur City Council voted unanimously to require massage parlors operating within city limits to obtain licenses, a move opening them up to inspections by the police and fire departments, as well as city building inspectors. The idea was to crack down on businesses advertising themselves as massage parlors, but actually are houses of prostitution or offer other illicit sexual services. Such businesses operating in the shadows often employ victims of human trafficking and advertise their services on the dark web. ISP has upped its human trafficking enforcement in recent years. Since 2020, every graduating police cadet has received human trafficking recognition training. And under legislation signed late last month by Governor J.B. Pritzker, ISP will be able to use images from license plate reader cameras on the state's highways in investigations involving human trafficking. The online e-edition of the paper also provides an audio article titled Services Available for Human Traffic Victims and a Parlors of Abuse: Our Nation's Sex Trafficking Gauntlet from David Lee Heath Enterprises. For more information, you can contact Brendan Moore at brendan.moore@lee.net or follow him on Twitter at brendanmoore13. Again, from our front page, Election 2026, Stratton, no corporate PAC money from Brendan Moore in Springfield. Among the storylines in the Democratic primary race for the U.S. Senate seat held by retiring Senator Dick Durbin has been money. So far, it's mainly centered around the eye-popping amount Representative Raja Krishnamurthy launched his campaign with and has subsequently raised. The Schomburg Democrat has more than $21 million cash on hand, according to his campaign. He has raised $3.1 million since declaring his candidacy, which his campaign portrayed as growing momentum and a solid foundation of support that have made it built to win. It also dwarfs the amount that the other major contenders, Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton and U.S. Representative Robin Kelly, have raised. Stratton announced last week that she raised more than $1 million since launching her campaign. Kelly has not yet released her latest fundraising totals, but had about $2 million in her account as of the end of March. However, Stratton is trying to turn this numeric deficit into a political advantage. Stratton's campaign on Monday confirmed that it will not accept contributions from corporate political action committees, calling the stance a clear difference between her and the other Democrats in the primary. "I'm not taking any corporate PAC money, because this campaign is about Illinois families, not corporate special interests," Stratton said in a statement. "Corporations are giving tens of millions of dollars to politicians, and politicians then reward those corporations. That broken system does not serve the people who I have always put front and center and who will be my focus in the Senate." In fundraising pitches for small-dollar donations, Stratton's campaign has been highlighting the decision to reject corporate PAC money while simultaneously asking people to help power our grassroots movement. According to Stratton's campaign, 84% of contributions have been less than $50, and 93% have been less than $250. According to Open Secrets, a nonpartisan research group that tracks money in politics, a political action committee is organized for the purpose of raising and spending money to defeat candidates. PACs can give $5,000 to a candidate in both the primary and general election. They mostly represent corporate, labor, or ideological interests. Individual donors, on the other hand, can give candidates $3,500 per election. Stratton was the first candidate to jump into the race to succeed Durbin. But as a state-elected official, she started at a significant financial disadvantage to Krishnamurthy and Kelly, who as House members have had federal campaign accounts for years that can now be used in the Senate race. Whereas money raised in state campaign accounts cannot be transferred into a federal account. Stratton did not have much in her state account in any case, given that she was on the ticket with Governor J.B. Pritzker, a billionaire self-funder. Across her congressional career, Kelly has taken about $3.9 million from PACs aligned with business interests, according to Open Secrets. Krishnamurthy has raised about $3.2 million. However, those include groups many would not associate with large corporate interests, such as the Illinois Corn Growers Association and the Asian American Hotel Owners Association, for example. Both have donated to Kelly and Krishnamurthy's campaigns. Robin Kelly has an unparalleled record of standing up against special interests and delivering for the people of Illinois at every level of government, said Kelly spokesperson Eileen Boyce. "No one else in this race has stood up to the gun lobby and won." Krishnamurthy's campaign also dismissed any notion that he is beholden to corporate interests. Political stunts aside, Raja is the only candidate in this race with a record of taking on corporate bad actors and winning, and that's exactly why he'll be an excellent U.S. Senator for Illinois, said a spokesperson for Krishnamurthy's campaign. He has dedicated his career to holding corporate bullies accountable, whether it's Big Pharma for hooking an entire generation on opioids, food manufacturers for poisoning baby food, Big Tobacco for addicting our kids, or grocery chains for threatening to hike up food costs. The no corporate PAC money pledge has become popular among the Democratic grassroots in recent years, and many candidates for state and federal office have taken it up. In 1998, Democrat Glenn Pochard made his vow not to take corporate PAC money, a centerpiece of his ultimately unsuccessful campaign for Illinois governor. While viewed by some as a principled stand at a time when corporations, labor unions, and wealthy individuals can exert outsized influence on American elections, there are many ways around the pledge. For one, people associated with certain interest groups can simply donate to campaigns in their personal capacity. PACs can also spend money on supporting or opposing candidates on their own, and labor unions, one of the major players in election spending, are not included under the corporate umbrella. Then there's the presence of super PACs, which may raise unlimited amounts from corporations, unions, associations, and individuals to advocate for or against a specific candidate while not coordinating directly with their campaign. Last month, Illinois Blue PAC was formed to support Stratton's candidacy. Stratton herself launched Level Up PAC earlier this year, which could also be used as a vehicle to support her Senate bid if she cuts direct ties with it. Either one could be used by Pritzker, who has endorsed Stratton to financially boost her candidacy. The governor, however, has not yet said what level of financial support he will lend to his number two. While Krishnamurthy and Stratton have announced their latest top-line fundraising numbers, none of the major candidates have filed their latest quarterly reports, which are due July 15th. Petitions to secure a place on the March 17, 2026 primary ballot can start to be circulated next month. The Cook County Democratic Party, the state's largest, will hold its slating for the primary later this month. From our local and state page, from Tony Reed in Decatur, cops shoot burglar with non-lethal shotgun round. Police said a Decatur man came home from a July 4th party to find a burglar lying on his couch. The intruder had stolen the man's handgun. When he later refused officer commands to step outside, police stormed the house and incapacitated the suspect by shooting him with a non-lethal shotgun round, according to a sworn affidavit. The drama unfolded around 11 p.m. July 5th, after the 41-year-old homeowner returned to his house in the 600 block of North Virginia Avenue and found Shannon S. Jones, 29, sprawled on the living room couch. The homeowner is quoted as saying he dashed to the bedroom to get his handgun, but found it was gone. The homeowner said he ordered Shannon to leave his residence, however Shannon just mumbled, said Decatur Police Department Officer Lacey Middleton, who signed the affidavit. The homeowner said he then exited his residence and proceeded to call 911. Middleton said police arrived just in time to meet Jones exiting through the home's front door, but he retreated back inside when he caught sight of the officers. Officers set up a perimeter around the residence and gave loud verbal commands for Shannon to exit the residence, Middleton said. Shannon never exited the residence. Ultimately, officers made entry into the residence and located Shannon in the living room. Shannon disregarded verbal commands to get on the ground. Shannon was then hit with a non-lethal sock shotgun round, where he then got on the ground and was taken into custody. The affidavit does not say precisely when the home was stormed, but it lists Jones being arrested at 1 a.m. July 6th. Officers located a suitcase in the house that had been filled with $1,300 worth of the homeowner's possessions, including a loaded pistol magazine, watches, various valuables, knives, cash, and the homeowner's social security card and passport. The stolen gun was found under a cardboard box near where Jones was arrested. Jones is quoted as telling police he knew the homeowner and had been previously allowed to sleep at the house and take showers there. He claimed to have a key to get in, but the key in his possession did not fit the front door, Middleton said. Shannon was asked if he was armed with the handgun while officers were on the scene, Middleton added. Shannon stated he was two steps ahead of the police while on scene. Jones was arraigned Monday in Macon County Circuit Court on charges of armed violence and residential burglary. Judge Rodney Forbes denied him pretrial release on the grounds he posed too much of a threat to public safety to be set free. The defendant is due back in court July 16th for a preliminary hearing when he will enter pleas to the charges against him. Train cars derail near ADM plant, Decatur, from Tony Reed. Emergency crews were working the scene of a multi-car train derailment Monday, close to the Archer Daniels Midland plant by East Ferries Parkway. Part of the road near North Brush College Road was shut down following the derailment that involved around six Norfolk Southern cars hauling beans. Justin Kraus, a battalion chief with the Decatur Fire Department, said he was notified around 8 a.m. there had been a derailment. He said he went to the scene to check it out, but relaxed when he realized the freight cars were not carrying anything toxic or hazardous. Fortunately, no chemicals, no hazardous materials, and nobody hurt, Kraus told the Herald and Review. Just a big mess for those rail guys to clean up. Sergeant Brandon Rolfs with the Decatur Police Department said he had similar concerns about what the rail cars might be carrying after being notified of the derailment. That was our primary concern. Was there any type of hazardous gas or corrosive fluid or anything like that, he said. Once we found out it was grain or beans or whatever it was, we left it to the railroad and the city's street department to take charge of. A statement from Norfolk Southern said the cars were loaded with soybeans and confirmed no rail staff or members of the public had been hurt during the incident. Cleanup is underway and is estimated to be done by 5 p.m. Monday, the statement added. And now from our opinion page, our theme is mission accomplished? Question mark. Our first column from James Fitzpatrick, who is the director of the Center to Advance Security in America. His column is titled, Trump Shows America Won't Tolerate Threat. President Donald Trump's decision to strike Iran's nuclear capability is a turning point in modern foreign policy, one that will keep the United States, the American people, and Americans abroad safe for years. It sends a signal to our adversaries. America will not tolerate the threat of nuclear-armed rogue states. Trump's decision was bold and consistent with his America First outlook. The Western world widely agrees that Iran must never possess nuclear weapons. Iran is responsible for the deaths of hundreds of Americans and thousands of others worldwide. Iranian leadership has called for death to America and the destruction of Israel. Iran has sponsored terrorist attacks and assassination attempts on four continents and in the United States. It may have helped plan Hamas's October 7, 2023 atrocities in Israel, in which 1,000 Israelis were killed and American citizens were taken hostage. This is a regime that thrives on violence and destabilization, undergirded by martyrdom in the cause of jihad. Iran's nuclear ambitions are the logical next step. Every U.S. president since Bill Clinton has agreed in principle that Iran should never have a nuclear weapon, but they haven't all shown the same resolve. President Barack Obama's nuclear deal gave significant concessions in exchange for minimal limitations on Iran's nuclear program. He even sent them $1.3 billion in cash to sweeten the deal. Not to be outdone, President Joe Biden released $6 billion to Iran in September 23 as part of a prisoner swap. The administration claimed the money was only for humanitarian use, but money is fungible, and the American people aren't that gullible. Trump's America First foreign policy has always made room for denying the mullah's nuclear weapons. It would be negligent to shrug off a threat to the homeland. Even before Iran could develop intercontinental missile technology, dirty bombs or suitcase nukes could wreak destruction on a U.S. city. Consider the trouble Iran causes without a nuke, and then imagine a world vulnerable to Iranian nuclear blackmail. The mutually assured destruction that has maintained stability between nuclear-armed powers since the 1950s may not hold sway over a regime that welcomes martyrdom. From his first day on the 2016 campaign trail, Trump has said Iran must never obtain a nuclear weapon. His strategy unfolded in several phases, withdrawing from Obama's Iran deal in 2018, reimposing crippling economic sanctions, designating the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terrorist organization, eliminating terror mastermind Qasem Soleimani, negotiating the Abraham Accords, which brought historic diplomatic breakthroughs between Israel and Arab nations. Trump issued a final 60-day deadline in April for Iran to abandon its nuclear program. Iran didn't comply, so the United States moved to destroy its nuclear facilities. This decisive action will reshape global perceptions of American leadership and deterrence. Iran's token retaliation against an American base was ineffectual, and it has agreed to cease fire with Israel, a testament to the effectiveness of the administration's strength-based diplomacy. The era of red lines with no consequences is over. Peace through strength is more than a slogan. It is a proven doctrine for ensuring American national security. This is the right path forward for the safety of the American people and a powerful reaffirmation that Trump is willing to act to put America first. We'll read the second column, titled Attack Makes Our Foes Covet Nukes Even More, in the second half reading of the Decatur Herald and Review for today. Now from our money page, personal finance and advice, four ways to keep your financial data safe from bad actors. 1. Keep information private when you can. Decline to share sensitive information when possible, whether it's your social security number at the doctor's office or an app requesting your data, suggests Eva Velasquez, president and CEO of the Identity Theft Resource Center. The more you put out there, the more risks and vulnerabilities you create for yourself, she said. 2, treat all communications with suspicion. Impersonation scams where scammers pretend to be a business or financial institution are among the most commonly reported scams to the Identity Theft Resource Center, a nonprofit that provides identity crime education and assistance. The number one rule is, if someone is presenting you with an offer that's too good to be true, it probably is, says Clayton Leaboton, senior executive advisor to Truecaller, a caller ID and spam blocking service. That includes emails or texts that claim to offer jobs, money, sweepstakes prizes, or other winnings. The number two rule is be wary of any inbound communications that are asking you for any personally identifiable information. If someone calling asks for your address, contact information, social security number, or banking details, hang up right away, he says. Thanks to AI, scam calls can sound completely legitimate, making it easier than ever for people to get tricked into thinking they are communicating with a legitimate caller. Anyone can sound like an authority figure, Leah Broughton says. That's why Yolanda Ayira, who holds digital literacy classes for seniors at AT&T Connected Learning Centers, urges participants to end calls right away if the caller asks for money, even if it sounds like a family member. Instead, she suggests hang up and try them back on a known number. Even if the voice sounded like someone you know, it could be AI. Call and verify, she says, and don't worry about being rude when your finances are on the line. Similarly, consider turning off sharing or public settings on payment apps and other apps with social components. That will allow you to keep more of your information private. Unless you can come up with a concrete reason worth sharing that information, just don't. 3, monitor and consider freezing your credit. Paid credit monitoring services can alert you to new credit applications made in your name, large transactions, or other changes to your account. You also can get free access to free credit monitoring through some banks. The website annualcreditreport.com allows you to access free weekly credit reports. Velasquez recommends credit freezing as another protective measure. Freezing your credit prevents anyone from opening up a new account in your name. If you want to apply for a new line of credit yourself, you'll have to unfreeze your credit through each credit bureau, either online, by phone, or by mail. Number 4, focus on reducing the risks you can control. While you might not have any control over a company's data breach or third-party data sellers, you can incorporate smart privacy protections into your daily life, Bayault says. Add two-factor authentication to your financial and email accounts. Don't log into financial accounts on public Wi-Fi networks. Keep the software on your device's operating systems updated. These are easy but important steps to take, he says. Catching fraud early can almost minimize damage. Monitoring your credit card and bank statements for errors can help you flag problems early. If you discover fraud, alert your financial institutions immediately. You can also report the fraud to local police, the FBI, the Federal Trade Commission, and your state's attorney general's office. Even if you take all these steps, bad things can still happen, Rayalt says, but at least you can minimize your chances of compromising your data. from Kimberly Palmer, NerdWallet. Our food page today has a delicious looking recipe for grilled sausage, peppers, and onions with herb vinaigrette to serve four. Adding a bright parsley tarragon vinaigrette brings fresh flair to sausage and peppers. Serve with some crusty bread to sop it all up. Grilling season calls for a delicious sausage and peppers dish, all sizzle. Today in history. On this date in 1850, President Zachary Taylor died of gastrointestinal illness after consuming a large amount of cherries and iced milk. Vice President Millard Fillmore was sworn in as president the following day. In 1868, the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was ratified, granting citizenship and equal protection under the laws to anyone born or naturalized in the United States, including formerly enslaved people. In 1896, William Jennings Bryan delivered his famous Cross of Gold speech at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. In 1918, 101 people were killed in a train collision in Nashville, Tennessee, in the deadliest U.S. rail disaster in history. In 1937, a fire at 20th Century Fox storage facility in Little Ferry, New Jersey, destroyed most of the studio's silent films. In 1943, during World War II, the Allies launched Operation Husky, the invasion of Sicily. In 1944, during World War II, American forces secured Saipan as the last Japanese defenses fell. In 1965, the Sonny and Cher single, I Got You, Babe, was released. In 1982, Pan Am Flight 759, a Boeing 727, crashed in Kenner, Louisiana, shortly after takeoff from New Orleans International Airport, killing all 145 people aboard and 8 people on the ground. From Jennifer McDermott, Associated Press, underwater turbine shows promise as clean energy. Submerged in about 44 yards of water off Scotland's coast, a turbine has been spinning for more than 6 years to harness the power of ocean tides for electricity, a durability mark that demonstrates the technology's commercial viability. Keeping a large or grid-scale turbine in place in the harsh sea environment that long is a record that helps pave the way for bigger tidal energy farms and makes it far more appealing to investors, according to the trade association Ocean Energy Europe. Tidal energy projects would be prohibitively expensive if the turbines had to be taken out of the water for maintenance every couple of years. Tidal energy technologies are still in the early days of their commercial development, but their potential for generating clean energy is big. According to the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, marine energy, a term researchers use to refer to power generated from tides, currents, waves, or temperature changes, is the world's largest untapped renewable energy resource. The Maygen Tidal Energy Project off the coast of Scotland has 4 turbines producing 1.5 megawatts each, enough electricity collectively to power up to 7,000 homes annually. Achieving 6 years in the water with constant operations is a very significant milestone that bodes well for the future of tidal energy, said Remy Gruet, CEO of Ocean Energy Europe. There are very few tidal energy projects generating electricity continuously. Most have been tests and demonstrations, said Andrea Copping, an expert in marine renewable energy development. Copping said there are still large hurdles to overcome before tidal energy can be adopted more widely, such as dealing with regulatory issues, potential environmental effects, and conflicts with other ocean issues. Still, the Scotland project seems to have addressed the question of whether the turbines can last in seawater, added Copping, a distinguished faculty fellow in the School of Marine and Environmental Affairs at the University of Washington. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, July 9th. Please stay tuned.